What will Florida lawmakers get done this year? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Florida lawmakers are gearing up for a new session ready to start in March, and their main priority? Tackle the governor's budget, the biggest in state history. We're joined by State Senator Annette Tadeo to talk about priorities and her take on the president's State of the Union as well as continued pressure on Venezuela. Also, we go to the Southernmost Bureau to look closer into the affordable housing issue that is plaguing the Keys. And
we had to raise $100 million. I think it's probably the most raised for a cultural institution in Palm Beach County.
The Norton Museum of Art in West Palm Beach is about to reopen this weekend after a massive renovation. We'll take you there. Finally, remember some of the challenges you faced back in middle school transitioning to adulthood? There's a new performance at MDC Live Arts that tackles that story through the lens of basketball. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. We are just a few weeks away from the 2019 legislative session in Florida, and there are quite a few new faces in Tallahassee. We're going to begin a series leading up to that session today. We're going to start with a conversation with Democratic State Senator Annette Tadeo, representing Miami-Dade County, parts of Miami-Dade County. She joins us now. We're going to talk about Venezuela, the State of the Union. Obviously, we're going to talk about the session, the governor's budget, her main priorities, but we also want to hear from you. What are your thoughts on what you want to see lawmakers accomplish in this session? What are the big issues you want them to tackle? 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. You can also post your question on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial, and I will get to some of those questions today. Senator Tadeo, it's great to have you back.
I'm delighted to be back. Thank you.
You've got the session coming up. Before we get to the session, though, let's look big picture, the international news. The president in the State of the Union talked about Venezuela. This is a big issue down here.
Yes.
Trump is supporting interim president Juan Guaido. So are a lot of other countries. Now, you've called some weeks back for the Trump administration to denounce Nicolas Maduro. What do you think of what's been happening and what the U.S. needs to do next?
You know, I'm first of all, it's really hard for me to say that he's doing the right thing on anything. So, but when he's doing the right thing on something, we need to say it. And obviously, I did ask the entire delegation of Miami-Dade, and then went to Broward and asked them to do the same for us to unite in a bipartisan basis, sending a letter to the White House and to Congress asking for them to do exactly what they did, which is join the other countries in recognizing Guaido after they exercised their constitutional right to have an interim president and then call for elections.
Now, what can Florida do? Obviously, I mean, any big action, military action, it's got to be on a federal level. But what is Florida doing? Even under former Governor Rick Scott, there's been action to try to put some strain on Venezuela.
Yes, we passed a bill to not allow for us to invest in companies that were doing business there. I think that we're seeing a lot of the congressional delegation doing things that can be really, really helpful to Venezuelans here and Venezuelans there. For example, Donna Shalala has put in a bill to not sell arms or any of the things that they can use against the people who are going to the streets and protesting so they can have the change in government and a proper election. And you also have, in a bipartisan way, the TPS for Venezuelans, which is being offered both by Mario Diaz-Balart and Congressman Soto. So all of us at the state delegation of in Tallahassee are also in a bipartisan way joining with all those calls. So you know, I think we're moving in the right direction. It is going to be the pressure, I think, before we get to anything about opening or talking about military. Let's make sure that the financial pressure really tightens the belt. And that's when we started seeing, even going with the oil, that was extremely positive, because that's where you're seeing a lot of them being able to sort of stay afloat, even though very poorly.
What do you hear from, you know, Venezuelans or anybody who's related to Venezuelans here in South Florida? What are they saying about everything that's gone down? Are they feeling optimistic, or, I mean, what are you hearing?
They're very optimistic. I mean, I think that all of us have been through more than a decade of, especially here in South Florida, where we've seen a huge growth of Venezuelan community. you know, they're very optimistic and believe that as all these countries, once the Europeans joined the United States, Brazil, Colombia, Canada, all these other countries, we really are leaving them sort of hanging out there all alone. So at this point, I think it's moving in the right direction for there to be a change. What's really encouraging is the actual constitution in Venezuela and Guaido has inserted the ability for there to be negotiations for Maduro to get out. Now, nobody likes, you know, not punishing somebody that's been so evil, but at the same time, we need to make sure that there's a quick transition and elections like there should be.
Again, the number 800-743-9576, 800-743-9576. We are going to be talking about the session, but you can ask any question here. We have State Senator Annette Tadeo joining us. Let's transition. This is we're coming up on the one-year anniversary of the Marjory Stoneman Douglas tragedy. Last session, you had Parkland students and parents show up, putting pressure for gun legislation. It finally, something did happen. There was the Marjory Stoneman Douglas Act. Is there going to be any other further discussion on the issue of guns or gun violence?
Absolutely. And so it's already started. I can tell you that I don't see an appetite, thank goodness, to repeal the good things that were passed, the raising of the age, the additional restrictions that were not enough for many of us. But certainly I don't see any movement in repealing what was passed. What I do see movement, unfortunately, is in the arming of the teachers. I think we are having movement with bills and a discussion about doing that. And that concerns me greatly, of course, because we fought so hard to make sure that we didn't arm teachers. And here in Miami-Dade, we don't. But I don't want the state mandating and tying dollars to doing something that we're so much against in our community.
Part of it is the Guardian program.
That is the Guardian program.
So that's the part of the law. And that is the controversial part, in having anybody staff-wise on campus armed. The governor wants to spend more on school safety. We'll go through his budget. But your take on what he wants to do and what do you feel we still need to do to make schools safer?
Listen, I think Miami-Dade is doing the right thing in having, you know, an actual officer at every school. We're not seeing that in other areas of the state, and some areas of the state have decided to arm the school personnel. We can't in Miami-Dade tell somebody in Dixie County or up in the north areas or rural areas how to do things, just like we don't like them telling us how to do things down here. So we have to be flexible, but I am one of the ones that it's a clear opponent and working in the Senate to kill that part of it. But the funds need to come, and $58 million that were sort of left in the pot are now back. They are part of the budget that he proposed.
You were against,
yes,
the Stoneman Act.
I voted
against it.
And I voted against it because although we were successful in getting them to take out teachers, full-time teachers, they didn't take out part-time teachers. They didn't take out the cafeteria personnel. They didn't take out the janitors. They didn't take out the... So it was just like really sort of window dressing, and they were still arming school personnel, which obviously our community is very much against.
And the NRA appreciated the fact that you voted against it.
The NRA sent me, as part of a campaign, plan of theirs, send me a thank you letter. Clearly, I am completely against NRA. I never have worked with them, and it didn't work. The voters knew and know where I stand and know that I am back up there fighting to make sure that we keep our kids safe.
Does there have to be any other discussion beyond what was passed last year, again, on beyond school safety now, but just the issue, again, of guns?
Yes.
And, you know, I mean, we saw a number of cities that wanted to pass their own gun legislation, which is not allowed, but they went forward anyway. But I mean, do you think there's any discussion on guns coming up in the session?
And that is in the courts with those cities that joined together. That was my amendment to the bill that was voted along party line. We did raise our hands, so we got people on the record voting to not allow cities and counties and municipalities to be able to do their own gun laws. I am against that. I think that, again, I don't want to tell the rural areas how to do things. Don't tell Miami-Dade, Broward County, Palm Beach also how we function, because we're as big as some states. So we're clearly very different and feel differently about guns.
We're talking with Democratic State Senator Annette Tedeo, and we're talking now about the legislative session, which is just a few weeks away. And we want to know from you, what do you see as the top priority for lawmakers? Health care? Is it guns? Is it school safety? A better teacher pay? What is important for you? What do you want to see lawmakers get to in this session? Give us a call, 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. Or find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Post your questions, and I will get to some of them. Governor Ron DeSantis right away takes office right away. He's busy. He starts making a lot of moves. A lot of people are like, well, okay, pretty good. They like some of it. They don't like some of it. What do you think? What do you think of the first 3 weeks that he's in office and he's just jumping across the state, making a lot of things happen?
That's been surprising, not expected. And I don't know if it's because we were so used to the one extreme of Rick Scott that we're just now so happy to see somebody actually doing some things that we've been asking be done for a long time, paying attention to our environment, really investing in our environment and our water. Seeing that has been very well received, and you know, by both sides. Certainly putting more money into education, although I once you go into the nitty gritty, we'll talk about that. But
okay, so what do you think about, for example, I mean, he's asking for more for Everglades restoration.
That's great.
Wants to end the ban on smokable medical marijuana. He did remove the supervisor of elections in Palm Beach County and then allowed Brenda Snipes in Broward County to go ahead and walk away as she had planned. But, I mean, these are some of the big controversial ones. What don't you like about what he did? What do you like about what he's done?
Listen, I think that, you know, he's letting us know that he is prioritizing the environment, and we like that. He is letting us know that he is going to put more money into education and getting rid of some of the, you know, the SAT scores that were judging a lot of teachers and their pay, which really...
Their bonus is tied to how they scored on the SAT.
And the problem is, obviously, you score much better on the SAT in the areas that are not as poor, while in the poorer areas where we need, you know, to encourage our teachers to teach those kids who have parents working that can't help them with their homework, can't afford tutors, things like that. It's really not fair the way it was being done. So we're seeing some things. He's getting rid of Common Core. He's, you know, so we're seeing things that are encouraging. But at the same time, I can tell you that in the budget, for example, the PICO dollars, which are, for those that are listening, those are the dollars that go towards the maintenance and construction and things of the actual buildings of the school. Again, we're seeing $155 million going to charter schools, which are 600 schools across the state. And yet we have only $50 million going to our traditional public schools, which is 3,500 schools.
So that's one of your issues you have with his budget. His budget, the largest in Florida history, $91.3 billion, more spending for education per student,
yes,
per pupil spending.
And that is a good thing because, listen, last year we got totally screwed. But this year we're getting a 55 per pupil amount. So that's going to an increase. So that's going to be really, really, really welcome news.
So where do you see pushback on any, I mean, you mentioned a couple of things, but where do you see maybe the main pushback that you don't, anything you don't like about his budget when we come up on session?
Charter schools, obviously, that's always been something that bothers me tremendously. You know, the majority of our students, over 90% of them, go to public schools. I just mentioned the difference between 3,500 schools and 600 schools, and yet you're getting three times as much money for your buildings. Here in Miami-Dade County, we keep taxing ourselves to make up for the short end of the budget that we always get, but we're the county that gives the most money to Tallahassee. So it's not right that we're having to tax ourselves to rebuild the schools, get them up to code, getting up to standard. And yet, you know, the private corporations of charter schools are getting, and they did last year too, getting three times as much for those dollars. And the rest of us just continue to tax ourselves.
When you look ahead to this session, what is your biggest priority? What do you want to tackle?
Well, I'll tell you, as a Democrat, a lot of our time we spend killing things. So I think one of my biggest priorities is making sure that we don't arm our teachers. That, to me, is a huge mistake and something that we're not going to do. So that's a negative.
But that's interesting. Do you feel because the party in power is the Republicans that you spend more time on the defense than you can on the offense?
No, there's a few things that we know that we can work on and that we work in a bipartisan basis. I think we're going to be able to work in a bipartisan basis, for example, on affordable housing. That's something that is critical for Miami-Dade County. And actually, that is something else in the budget. For the first time, we are not raiding the Affordable Housing Trust Fund, which is the Sadowski Fund. I will tell you, last year we got a little bit. But seeing that we are actually not using this money that we desperately need for our community and for affordable housing is the biggest breath of fresh air, I think. And we have a bill, and we're hoping that this means that we'll be able to get there, where we have a bill that we will actually make it illegal to raid the Sadowski Fund, just like it is illegal to raid the what I call the NRA fund, because the NRA decides what to do with those dollars.
800-743-9576. Your question about the upcoming legislative session, what do you want to see lawmakers tackle in this session? Let me go to the phones. I'm going to go to Mike in Miami. Mike, thanks for waiting.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you for taking my call.
What's your question?
The question I have, the solicitation calls. Vendors now discover ways where they could just call you with different numbers. And you block a number, and they call you with multiple numbers after that. And during the election, I heard all the agriculture commissioners talk about this, and things will be done. It's really becoming very annoying as one person and talking to people. It's becoming very annoying. And I just like to hear from actually my senator what will be done regarding this issue. And Senator Tadeo, I'm a great fan of yours.
Aww.
Mike, thanks so much for the call. So basically, I mean, he's talking about robocalls.
No, I think he's talking about those sales calls.
Well, there's sales calls, but he also mentioned robocalls.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. Now, I want to be clear and say that we did pass a bill last year. It was bipartisan to try to tackle this issue. And now the Agriculture Commissioner will get to put it into effect. But definitely, It was tackled last year in legislation to come after these companies. It makes it harder. I do it myself. I get the call on my cell phone, and I try to wait till the end because they're supposed to tell you who's calling and who's paying for this. Not in politics. You can't restrict those kind of calls. I do want to tell people that those are exempt because people don't know about that. But the other ones, they are not allowed, and they're not following the rules or the law.
This is a tricky one too, because you get on that no call list, but they find a way around it.
Yes.
Let me go back to the phones. Let me go to Sergio in Parkland. Sergio, thanks for waiting.
My pleasure, and thank you for your position, Senator Tadeo, in regards to your the banning of guns and teachers having access to them and making them become gods. My question is regarding the constitutional amendment that's going to be proposed in 2020 that the people are obtaining signatures for, banning assault weapons. I'd like to hear your comments and your position.
Sergio, thank you so much. All right, so again, back on the issue of guns and assault weapons.
There is a collection of signatures. I am very much in support of letting the voters decide on banning assault weapons, and I'm for banning assault weapons, but I realize that is not something that in the current makeup of party in Tallahassee that we're going to be able to pass it. So for that reason, I am in favor of taking it to the voters and passing it that way, just like I'm also working on the collection of signatures to expand Medicaid. That is a bill that I keep bringing up. I brought it up last year, again this year, to let the voters decide, since, you know, our politicians have not had the courage to do that.
We're talking about Senate Resolution 284.
Yes.
On Medicaid expansion. Yeah, Democrats have failed, what, three times now on this? So
we're taking it to the voters. And the reason why I'm proposing actually just letting the voters decide, and we as legislators can put things on the ballot, but they won't even hear the bill. But that's fine. We're getting the signatures and then putting it on the ballot, and is very, very much something that people want done. So I think it'll pass.
And real quickly, before we finish up, talking about sending it to the voters, the other thing that came down this past week was the state Supreme Court decided not to hear the argument on the minimum wage from Miami Beach. Now, this shows
yes.
The court is new. You got new faces, so it shifted. But there is a push
yep.
To get this on the ballot, the $15 minimum wage, $15 per hour minimum wage. Do you get the sense that these bigger issues now have to be pushed to a ballot to get to the voters? Because you're not going to be able to work it in the legislature.
It's really sad that we are we're having a humongous ton of constitutional amendments, and that's how we're legislating. But that's what it's come down to do the big picture items that our politicians are not willing to do. So, yes, minimum wage is going to be another one on the ballot.
You still got committee meetings all the way up through all the way up through the session, and then
yes.
The session starts.
Yes.
How are you feeling about just I'm going to wrap on this. How are you feeling about this upcoming session?
I actually feel good. Obviously, it's a positive budget. I think that there are going to be big fights, obviously, regarding guns. That's going to be a big issue. Transportation as well. I know this is a big issue for Miami-Dade County, so I asked again not only to be on the main transportation committee, but I'm also on TED appropriations, which is transportation, economic development, and tourism. And I think that's really important that we get our money back. We're going to have a little bit of a fight. We're already having it about MDX. And clearly tolls. We just had a hearing on SunPass and the debacle of that company that was hired to do this. So we are hitting them hard and making sure that we hold them accountable for making us pay all these bills all at once now when we're getting the bills in the mail.
This is the fun time. This is the busy time for you. So Democratic State Senator Annette Tadeo, again, joining us. It's been such a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
And again, you can always post your comments, your questions on our Facebook or Twitter. We'd love to hear from you, your thoughts on what you want to see lawmakers get done this session. Find us at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, we're going to take a brief look at one group in the Keys trying to help alleviate the affordable housing issue down south. That's coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Residents in the Florida Keys have long struggled to find affordable housing. A new report from the United Way illustrates how dire the situation has become. More than 40% of residents in the Keys can't afford basic needs like food, health care, housing, and transportation. And the average single person spent 44% of their income on housing, or nearly $1,000 a month. Hurricane Irma further exacerbated the problem, particularly in the Middle Keys, destroying pre-existing housing units and forcing thousands of residents to start over. WLRN's Nancy Klingener spoke with one church leader in Marathon who has an interesting solution for some residents. And Nan joins us now for this story from the studios of Key West. She also has an update, by the way, on this week's sunscreen ban vote. That was a big one as well. Nan, great to talk to you.
Hi, Lewis.
All right, so let's start with the housing issue. Prior to Hurricane Irma, how bad, just remind everybody, how bad the affordable housing issue was in the Florida Keys?
It's been bad because we have a couple things going on here. Limited supply, high demand, and very strict limits on how much new building we can do. And all of those things just combine to keep squeezing affordable housing out.
And you have the limits on what you could build, but at the same time, what's the other barrier that's keeping them from building any kind of affordable housing? Because you have a workforce you need.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the limits, I guess, like I said, we're very strictly limited on how many new units we can add to the Keys because we have to be able to get everybody out of here 24 hours before a hurricane. But at the same time, the squeeze from the other end, the demand is coming from vacation rentals and second homeowners and retiring baby boomers who are buying their dream house in the Keys. And maybe they live here part-time and maybe they rent it out monthly the rest of the time or not. But in any case, that takes those homes and condos and other living units off the market for people who work here.
So we had a fascinating story you had produced for, that played the other day, and it was about this church group. And I wanted to ask you about Deborah McConaughey and the church that she's part of and what role they're playing.
Yeah, it's St. Columba Episcopal Church in Marathon, and she's been the pastor, the rector there for 12 years. And she's very involved in the community in lots of ways. And after the storm, they brought in some trailers to get people housed, you know, in the immediate aftermath. But they just thought that's not enough. We need a longer term solution. So she started looking around and thinking we need to actually buy property and become landlords.
And how did they acquire this? Because they have an apartment complex, right?
Yeah, it's 16 units. It's two buildings with four. It's 16 units total.
Yeah.
In Marathon. And they got a big grant from Episcopal Relief and Development, which is the Episcopal Church's disaster agency. And that gave them most of the money toward a down payment, and they put like 40% down, so they won't have a huge mortgage. And they're fixing it up, and they're going to rent it out.
Now, she acknowledged that in your story that this was a small step to a bigger problem. Let's take a listen.
After the storm, we thought, if we don't do something, we're going to lose our community. It won't be a community anymore. So we thought, if everyone kind of does a little bit, you know, like 16 units, it's not going to save the world. Definitely that's true, but it's going to help 16 people have a home, or 32 people have a home, or you know, a young child or something. And there's no place like home. You know, not just Dorothy doesn't say that. We all know that.
Nan, to your knowledge, have there ever been a church or any group that's come in and done anything like this, or is this really unique?
I don't know how unique it is. I wouldn't be surprised if a church had done this before. Certainly right after the storm, there were many, many faith groups that came in and were a huge help to people in the Keys. And even before Irma, for example, Catholic Charities has been doing transitional housing and other work to help people keep their homes and have a place to live here in Key West. So I don't know how unusual it is, and I would not be surprised if they weren't the first.
We're talking with WLRN reporter Nan Klinginer, joining us from the Southernmost Bureau, and we've been talking about the affordable housing issue in the Keys, also sharing her recent story about a church that is trying to build apartments for folks, affordable housing for folks. Again, just a small little piece of the problem, trying to solve the problem. By the way, go to WLRN.org to listen to that story so you can hear more, because it is a fascinating story. Now I want to shift things over and let's talk about a recent vote in the Keys, talking about, well, let's just say the Keys made history. Let's hear it.
Commissioner Davila.
No.
Commissioner Hoover.
Yes.
Commissioner Kaufman.
Yes.
Commissioner Lopez.
Yes.
Commissioner Wardlow.
Yes.
Commissioner Weekly.
Oh, yes.
Mayor Johnston.
Yes. Motion passes.
All right, so that's the sound of Key West commissioners passing the resolution to ban certain types of sunscreens that have two chemicals in them. Nan, take us there. Well, I mean, obviously we heard the clapping, but there was a lot of support for this.
There was, and that was the second reading, both of them very long, dozens of people testifying at both meetings, most of them supporting this ban on the sale of these sunscreens with these two chemicals in them.
Let's remind people that the ban doesn't go into effect until 2021. Why is that?
That's the same time period that Hawaii's ban, which Key West's ban was modeled after, will go into effect. And there were two reasons that they decided to push it back a year in Key West. And one was so that they could have more time to evaluate the science behind these claims that the chemicals are damaging the reef. And another was because if there's a legal challenge, they were like, let's let Hawaii take that instead of the little city of Key West.
And they're health experts who've been saying from the beginning, but then, you know, there's a great risk of a greater risk of skin cancer if people aren't using this stuff.
Right. A bunch of dermatologists came to the first reading and the Personal Healthcare Products Association made that point. And their point isn't that these are the only sunscreens, but they were saying these are the sunscreens with these chemicals are the ones that people like to wear. The mineral-based sunscreens can be a little more sort of chalky on your skin, although they're getting better at that, I've noticed in my own personal use. They were saying the best sunscreen is one that people will actually use. So they were concerned that people would not use sunscreen if it wasn't available to them. The answer to that from the advocates for this ban is that, A, there's lots of alternatives and more all the time. And, B, you can always just cover up, wear long sleeves, wear a hat, do all that stuff.
And I'm just going to mention real quickly, there is now a proposal in the state legislature to ban those sunscreens with those chemicals statewide, but we'll follow up on that story. Again, Nan Klinger joining us from the Southernmost Bureau in Key West. Nan, thanks so much.
Thank you, Lewis.
All right, still to come, the Norton Museum is about to reopen with more than $100 million in renovations. The Sundial team went there to West Palm Beach. We're going to take you there as well. Coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Have you ever been to the Norton Museum of Art in West Palm Beach? I got to admit, I mean, as a former art student, it's one of my favorite places to go. And it's got this amazing collection of art. It's got a Monet and a Cezanne and a Pollock and a Picasso. It's got a little bit of everything. Well, it's got a lot more room now for more art because it went through a $100 million renovation, and it's going to reopen this weekend. By the way, that renovation done by world-renowned architect Norman Foster. The museum will celebrate its grand opening again this weekend with a big party. The Sundial team went there recently, and we spoke with Hope Oswong, the museum's executive director and CEO.
When the new Norton opens up, what will be the most significant changes that the patrons who've enjoyed this for years right away are going to notice?
I think they're going to notice increased programming in really fantastic spaces. So, for instance, having a raked auditorium with fantastic acoustics, more programming around music, more programming altogether. I think they're going to notice a fantastic restaurant. I think they're going to be aware of a really amazing sculpture garden. Of course, they're going to see our galleries, but if you're talking about our visitors who have been involved with us for a while, I think those things are going to be a real wow for them.
My understanding is they were thinking about this expansion even before you got here?
What they said was they knew they had a problem with their building. I don't think they were thinking about an expansion. They were talking about the fact that the building seemed unfriendly and, although adequate, wasn't solving as many problems as they would like. So that was the beginning of the discussion.
So then you come in, and what was that process like, and how long did it take to get to the point where you knew you were going to be able to do this construction and then, of course, begin the work?
So I think it was an 8-year process, and I guess within the first 18 months I realized that we would probably be in a really major capital campaign and be doing a very large project. But the master plan, which is how we started with Foster and Partners, wasn't complete. So it wasn't clear to me how large an intervention we would do. This way exceeded my expectations of the kind of project. And I think a lot of board members were really surprised when we started to talk about a really large number on the campaign. That was a huge issue for, I think, us to figure out, could we afford it and could we make it work?
And can you tell us a little bit about that campaign and how much you had to raise to make this possible?
We had to raise $100 million. I think it's probably the most raised for a cultural institution in Palm Beach County. That's all private except for $1 million from the state of Florida. It's a lot of money to raise. And in the beginning, we did not have largely gifts, although they were large gifts. Many people would think in a campaign like that, you would start with a big number, like a $10 or $20 million gift. We were starting with gifts of $1 and $2 million. Now, those are very generous gifts. It takes a lot of them to get to $100 million. About a year and a half ago, Ken Griffin, who is, of course, who is going to be building on Palm Beach Island, came to our attention, and we started to get to know him. And he fundamentally made the end of the campaign by giving us a $20 million gift, which was a kind of upside-down experience because you're supposed to start with the $20 million, not end with the $20 million. But that was – I'm still raising money. I never stop raising money.
What was the process and the significance of getting Lord Norman Foster – as the architect for this?
Well, I think one of our board members had worked with him extensively in the big Hearst Tower in Manhattan, and so we were able to get access to him. I've always wondered what it would have been like if we were just the Norton Museum in West Palm Beach, and I had called the office and said, look, we're looking to talk to Foster and Partners about the possible expansion program, whether how much attention I would have gotten. But because we had a board member who was very close to Norman Foster, we got tremendous attention immediately. And they started saying the thing that we needed to do, which of course was absolutely right, is we need to understand your needs and make a master plan. And so the first 18 months was really a master plan, which was to give rationality to the building, address the things that we asked for, like a really good auditorium, like better facilities for our school children, more obviously significant, more gallery space. All of those things had been on our wish list. Once they started looking at that, they gave us a fantastic master plan.
What was it like working with him, and how much did you get to work with him?
I think we saw Norman actually in person probably every 3 or 4 months in London. I worked with his architects here on the ground a lot. We worked with a partner, Michael Wurzel, who was our lead partner on the project, and we had, you know, we would go to London and we would do reviews with Norman, and he would come in and we would basically critique to the place that we had gotten to, and he would offer pretty significant alterations and suggestions, and we would go through it. It was usually a two-day process. So in the beginning, I was going to London every 6 weeks. There's probably 10 major architects internationally, of which Foster is one of them. A lot of them do really outstanding work. The thing that I think defines Norman Foster and the way in which he approached our project is that he loves art. This is not true of all architects. A lot of architects like art, fine, but for Norman, who is himself a collector and a connoisseur, brought to our project an understanding of what our curators needed to make the very best place to show art. And that's because he really engages in the dialogue of the building and the art.
When you took this job, I'd read that you believed that this was one of the best, if not the best, museums in the South. Why did you think that? What is that for you and your experience? Why did you think this place really was that good?
For a museum director, really, it's all about the quality of the collections. We have fantastic collections, both from our founder and subsequent years. It's the highest, certainly the highest quality collection south of Richmond, Virginia, for sure. And I felt it was really under-recognized because we had such great paintings and sculpture. Our Chinese collection is breathtaking. And that, I think, drove me to think we could really do more to interpret this. But also, we are in a community with some of the greatest collectors in the world. It seemed like we were really missing an opportunity not to have them give us great things.
This expansion, everything that you've accomplished, now where does that put the Norton when you think about not just the, maybe in the South, but nationally, internationally?
Immediately in our first long-range plan was to say that although we would always be committed to our community, we were very interested in participating in the conversation nationally and internationally with what was going on in museums, what was going on in art, what was going on in contemporary art. And I think we've accomplished that.
What is the piece that you're most proud of, or the accomplishment you're most proud of?
There's two pieces to our accomplishment. One is this sort of really fantastic building with great new collections coming in quite unexpectedly from some of the world's most important collectors. But there's the other side of the equation, which we have always taken very seriously, which is Palm Beach County is a very large county, 1.5 million people. When I got here, I think our audiences were not as diverse, not as engaged on the level of the sort of county that we needed. And we've really expanded our local audience, and they come to everything and they really engage with us and they want to know what's going on, and not just about contemporary art, about all the stuff we show. And so it's the duality of that stuff, working at the very highest international level with the greatest art you can imagine, and then with our local community, which is very diverse and has extraordinary issues, both, as you know, economic issues in our county, and still getting people here by making sure we've been endowed 2 free days in our schedule. So both Fridays and Saturdays will be free, and we know that we can make ourselves available to our whole community in the fullest way.
You enjoy and appreciate art, and I wonder if you spend time just enjoying some of the work that you have here, and if there's a favorite piece.
That's a very interesting question. I have to say I don't have a favorite piece because it's a little bit like loving all my children equally. But I would say that our mid-century American, which are many of them have been in the collection from the very beginning, still mean a great deal to me just on a very personal level. You know, what I get most pleasure out is seeing what our curators do to create new stories and interpretation with art so that make me look at the art with new eyes. And that's their job, and they do it very successfully. So I look forward to every new show because I know it's going to teach me something.
You're retiring, and I wonder what you think your legacy is going to be, what you want it to be, and what do you hope the next director is going to do to take the Norton into the future?
You know, I think our legacy is a fantastic facility, but also an extremely high quality staff, which is functioning at an amazing level. Obviously, I hope that continues, and I hope that we continue to be very committed to a strong curatorial voice, which I always say a great hospital is its surgeons, a great university its professors, a great museum is its curators. Obviously, I think great directors are important too, but the real talent on the ground is the curators, and I hope that we continue to develop exceptional curators who do amazing work.
And again, that was Hope Alswang, the Norton Museum of Art's executive director and CEO. She said she's retiring this summer. By the way, you can see a Facebook Live of WLRN's digital director, Teresa Frontado's conversation with the architect behind the new renovation, Lord Norman Foster, and a lot of other photos. It is amazing, I promise you. Well, still to come, a new show by the NBC Live Arts Lab has brought basketball, dance, and growing up all in one show. It's coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Middle school can be challenging. I remember those days. You're dealing with adolescence and the responsibility that comes with growing up. A new dance performance commissioned by MDC Live Arts Lab explores that transition through the lens of basketball. Dove stars 13-year-old Izzy Lieberperson from Nautilus Middle School in Miami. He is playing as himself, and he's confronting a lot of these challenges and all of it while performing with a basketball. Pioneer Winter is a critically acclaimed producer and choreographer behind the performance. The Dance Collective was recently named by Dance Magazine 25 Companies to Watch. Izzy and Pioneer join me in studio. And again, just to mention that Dove is tonight and tomorrow at 8 p.m.
Yes.
At MDC Live Arts in Lab in Miami. Guys, thanks so much for being here, man. I appreciate it.
It's great to be
it's
here.
It's fun to be here.
Pioneer, let me start with you real quickly. Where did this idea come from?
Well, in all my choreography practice, I'm always really interested in working with unexpected bodies, bodies that are typically underrepresented in performance. And youth are definitely underrepresented voices in our community. So when I was commissioned by MDC Live Arts to create an original work, they really engendered this whole concept of risk-taking, of being able to use this opportunity to challenge myself as a choreographer. And that's how Dove came about. You know, what better way to be able to really look at dance critically and to be able to experiment than
and
to
talk about, talk about experiment. I mean, yeah. You're talking about this is something I've never seen anything like this, but did you find Izzy on Facebook, video?
Yeah, I'm friends with his parents,
okay.
and I would always see like videos that they would post of him playing basketball, and like he would move like what you would expect a dancer to move like when he would play.
And you're not a fan of basketball.
I know nothing about it.
But yeah, as you're watching, I mean, briefly describe to me that, you know, when you're watching a mm-hmm. an amazing, a talented basketball player moving with that basketball, it really is artistic. But I mean, how did you see it?
Oh, speed, fluidity, his ability to change directions and shift weight very quickly. Just like he's really prodigious with his skill. And, you know, it was just an easy thing to incorporate into a theatrical setting.
Izzy, how long have you been playing basketball?
Probably since I was like 2 or 3.
2 years old?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Hoops.
Well, anybody who hasn't seen you, you have an amazing skill, you know, in dribbling especially, mm-hmm. which is unbelievable. Tell me, what was it like when they said, hey, we want to do a dance show about you?
I mean, at first I thought it was like really cool to be in like a whole show mostly about me and like about me, all about me. So I said, yeah, sure, and just jumped right into it. And it's like, and it was like really fun now. And now it's like the show's coming up and stuff.
What's harder? Is basketball, training, practicing for basketball harder than dance? Or the other way around?
Well, it's mostly just like the mindset you put into it. Like if you want to train hard and like, it's going to be whatever you make harder, which is, but like at least for me, most of the time the rehearsals are harder for dancing.
Yeah.
Because it's like a, so like first of all, I just finished like a whole day of school. Right. So I have to,
exactly.
I have to come to this late night rehearsal and put a lot of stress on my body because it's very demanding.
Yeah. You know what? Here's the interesting thing. So you don't know anything about basketball, Pioneer. And I mean, but you, and Izzy, I take it, you didn't know a lot about dance. How did you guys communicate with each other? How do you help him understand what you're doing? How do you help Izzy understand, Pioneer, what, you know, everything that dancers will train for years and years and years?
Yeah. Well, it's just asking each other a lot of questions, having a vocabulary that we create. Like Izzy will improvise, like he'll be handling the ball and he'll do something like really cool, and I'll say like, stop, like remember what you just did. Okay, now can you do it again? All right, well, let's give it a name. Okay, well, now we'll add it to the toolbox of like terminology that we're creating together. So it's like creating a language.
And you know, the other thing too, dancers, I mean, they will work with props. But again, this is unique because the basketball is a lot of the art, mm-hmm. in watching that. So and just as a choreographer, I mean, and again, you're learning a sport you don't know. I mean, how long did it take for you and what did you do to figure out how you're going to turn his movement into a dance?
Well, it's just, you know, devised theater where I relied mostly on observing Izzy and how he moves and asking him questions, asking him to do something again, face a different direction, do something more than once, rather than where I'm asking him to copy me. So it was just like a really organic process from the beginning where we, neither of us were trying to get the other person to become a basketball player, become a dancer. Instead, it was like a meeting in the middle.
Again, I'm talking with Pioneer Winter. He's the choreographer behind the dance performance Dove, which is happening tonight and tomorrow at the MDC Live Arts Lab in downtown Miami. And it's the story of a 13-year-old boy coming of age told through basketball. And that 13-year-old, by the way, playing as himself, is Izzy Lieberperson. Real quickly, Izzy, I'll start with you, but I want to hear from both of you on this is, you know, nobody has seen the show. They don't know. They're listening to this interview and they're, okay, there's a kid playing basketball. How do you describe what you're going to be doing for 20 minutes?
Well, most of it,
what are you going to, how do you start? What do you do?
I start with, like a kind of like coming up out of the darkness kind of thing. And you see like my shadow and then you see my figure and I'm dribbling the basketball and kind of like a rhythmatic, sound. And then, yeah. And then it kind of gets everyone tuned in mostly because it's a very slow part. So everyone's just waiting for me to come out, see like, okay, what's happening? What's this kid gonna do? And then a lot of it goes from there with a lot of basketball sounds and things I could do with the basketball.
And then how does it end?
It ends with a soothing part. It's a surprise how...
Oh, it's a surprise. Okay, don't give it away. It's okay. Yeah, I mean, Pioneer, like, for how would you describe this to somebody, yeah. and to what to expect, and how to enter this kind of performance?
Well, I guess we could talk about what Dove means. Dove happens to be Izzy's middle name, and it also means bear in Hebrew. So it started off as just sort of like this superficial image that we were using, that we were sort of channeling throughout the piece, but it's become something I think that has more social commentary to it than we expected, where Izzy, like a bear cub, has like this capacity for, as he gets older, to become something that is maybe perceived by others as dangerous. And how does one grow into an adult that is someone that shouldn't be feared? And how are we, what are our perceptions of time, of sportsmanship, of fouling and being fouled. Just a lot of things that we come into contact, in everyday life, but aren't looking at it through the lens of basketball.
That's so fascinating. It's a dance. You're looking through life as basketball. Now you're sounding like a guy who knows basketball. You sounded like a professional announcer. Izzy, let me finish with you real quickly. I mean, after this experience, like I said, I watched you play and you're amazing. But what do you think? And do you think you want to try more theater and dance now?
I mean, at first, like a lot of the rehearsals, I was just saying let's see what happens. Let's get this over with. But now I'm really tuned into it, and I'm like really wanted it to go as well as possible. And I feel like this performance now means a lot to me. And like, I want it to be really good for me. And also just show people a good time, a good show. And yeah.
It is, again, it's called Dove. Izzy Lieberperson plays as himself. It is looking at growing up through the lens of basketball. It is part of the MDC Live Arts Lab. It's in downtown tonight and tomorrow. Pioneer Winters, the choreographer behind this amazing concept. Guys, thanks so much. You say break a leg, right? Break
yeah.
a leg.
Thank you.
All right. That's our program for today, this Thursday, February 7th. Have a wonderful Friday. Have a great weekend. I'm Luis Hernandez. We'll talk to you again on Monday.